Monster Man, episode 328, Beholder, Aquatic, and Brain Collector. Hello and welcome to Monster Man, a show about monsters because monsters are great. I'm James Holloway, and I'm reading my way through the gaming books of yesteryear. And as I do, I'm talking about the monsters that I find in them. Their history, their mythology, their ecology, their imagery, and how to use them in games. In today's episode, we're continuing our journey through the Monsters section of Creature Catalog, the 1986 supplement for Basic Dungeons & Dragons. Now, I observed earlier that the Monsters section is kind of a catch-all that includes things that don't necessarily fit into any of the more obvious categories. And today's monsters are no exception. We start off with the Beholder, Aquatic, which is a quite familiar monster. It's essentially the Eye of the Deep, which we saw back in, I think, in the first monster manual for Advanced Dungeons & Dragons. So this is a concept that has existed, you know, already for some time, right? That book came out in 1977. The Beholder is an interesting monster. Now, I don't want to go too much into the Beholder because we just did a recent special episode of Beholders, but I think what's really interesting about the Beholder is that it narrowly avoids being ridiculous. Now, that it's a little bit ridiculous, but it also is interesting and it's also challenging, and it's become kind of adopted by the game's players out of a sense of affection for its kind of, you know, it's goofy, but they like that goofiness. The Beholder, Aquatic fails in that respect. It's not really made it to the kind of D&D icon status that its terrestrial cousin has. And actually, an interesting fact is, I did not know this, but I read in a discussion about the Beholder, Aquatic, that the Eye of the Deep and the Gas Spore are not product identity monsters. So there are monsters in D&D that you can use in any game, and there are monsters in D&D that you can only use in D&D. So, for example, if you are writing a not official D&D module, you can't use Beholders because those are product identity. You can use Eye Monsters, you know, but you can't use Beholders. But you can use Gas Spores, creatures which make no sense unless Beholders exist in the world, and honestly, don't make a whole lot of sense even then. Part of it is the appearance of the Beholder. So the Beholder, Aquatic, or the Eye of the Deep, whatever you care to call it, has not really reached the heights of stardom that its more famous cousin has. Part of it is that it looks real goofy. Even in this illustration, the shape of the eye socket just gives the monster a kind of scowl that just looks a bit daft. The fact that it only has two eye stalks, which gives it the appearance of having antennas, and that it has little claw hands, both go toward, I mean, obviously this is not something that would have happened in 1986, but they both go toward making it look a little bit like Mike Wazowski from Monsters, Inc., who is not the most threatening monster in the world. Now, mechanically, the Beholder, Aquatic is actually kind of interesting, I think. It is another example of a monster that exists mainly to sort of complicate things for you in a hazardous environment. So, if you're underwater, the things that the Beholder, Aquatic can do, which would be less threatening on land, take on deadly new implications. It can emit a blinding flash from its central eye rather than the anti-magic cone. It can cast Charm Person and Hold Monster out of its two eye stalks, and it can combine the two to create very realistic and creative illusions. These are all things that, you know, if you're underwater, particularly if you're not using Breathe Water, which in basic D&D lasts for 24 hours, but only works on one person. So, you know, having a whole party able to breathe water is a pretty significant investment of party resources. There are lots of ways in which being misdirected or being paralyzed, you know, when you need to be swimming to stay afloat, for example, could actually be really dangerous. So the Beholder, Aquatic is probably more threatening than it looks on paper, because a lot of its powers, what they do is take away your ability to protect yourself against a dangerous environment. This is especially true if you're then going to be attacked by its, like, squad of sharkkin shock troopers or whatever. This is what I mean about how, in a mechanical sense, this monster is completely fine. It just lacks something. Variants on the Beholder are inherently an attempt to catch lightning in a bottle, and the thing about attempts to catch lightning in a bottle is that they don't really succeed. Speaking of monsters with a striking resemblance to other monsters from D&D, let's talk about the Nethalgu, or Brain Collector. Maybe it's unfair to say that the Nethalgu is very much like the Mind Flayer, because actually, I think they're not as similar as they might be thought to be, although they do both flay minds, I guess. The Nethalgu is a kind of Lovecraftian monstrosity, even down to the name, with a horrible, creepy face and big lumpy head and scary crab legs and all sorts. And to further reinforce the Lovecraftian comparison, they are creatures from another dimension who can only enter the prime material plane at certain points where the fabric between reality is thin because of excessive use of magic. Excessive use of magic, like the kind that you might get in a mansion inhabited by a family of mad wizards, which is why they make their appearance in X2 Castle Amber. A classic example of a, you know, house full of mad wizards being an explanation for everything. I've never read X2 Castle Amber, but I'm getting the impression that it is the funhouse dungeon. So they arrive in our dimension, and it's not clear why they do it, but it is clear what they want, and what they want is brains. Why they want them, no one knows. They're not like an intellect devourer that sort of sucks away your intelligence points. These guys cut open your skull, remove your brain, and put it in a special brain pouch located in their own heads. So they have these like bumps in their heads, which are spaces where they can put somebody's brain. I'll say this for the brain collectors, they have a very consistent kind of pulp sci-fi horror aesthetic, and I like it. They get mechanical benefits from acquiring new brains, which is that they can use them to learn and cast new spells. So more brains in the head, more spells in the head. Basically, you become part of their spellbook, which is pretty cool. They're, you know, I said they were like the Mind Flayers. I wonder actually if they're not a little bit more inspired by the Mego from the H.P. Lovecraft story, The Whisper in Darkness, who we talked about, I think, actually in Patron Deities, because they're in the Cthulhu Mythos chapter of Deities and Demigods. The Mego remove brains, although it's not for any personal reason. They do it just because it's a more convenient way to transport people with valuable knowledge across interstellar distances. They pop your brain in a special brain container, and then they just take the container and don't have to worry about your vulnerable human body. I think it was the role-playing game Spaceship Zero that really, I guess this is in Delta Green as well a little bit, but Spaceship Zero really went with the idea that, like, well, if you have a Mego brain container and you can attach any kind of attachments to it, well, then you can have all sorts of, you know, cool mechanical bodies and stuff, which I thought was an interesting idea. Here, it's a lot more kind of gruesome and biological. They can collect up to 12 brains, which I think is a nicely folkloric number. I would love the implication that the 13th brain is the one that sends them home. So, you know, this is very kind of like, it's very 90s horror movie-y, you know, you're finding a series of bodies all with the brain removed, and you have to, you know, race to catch the killer because with every brain, the brain collector becomes more powerful until finally it goes home, kind of solving your problem for you. So I don't know why. You could make it more interesting by saying that they want to collect specific brains, or that, you know, when it goes home, it'll be able to tell its fellow brain collectors about all the vulnerable brains here on the prime material plane, or something like that. This monster doesn't have many stakes to build a scenario around, because the basic stakes are that it wants specifically your brain, and you have to protect yourself against it. The Brain Collector has survived into later editions of Dungeons & Dragons. They're definitely in third, I want to say. I think they're in third. I don't know if they're in fifth, even though I have those books, but I don't recall off the top of my head. I think the reason that they have not really made as much of an impact as they might is that they have one of the problems that affects monsters that draw on a different aesthetic from the one that traditionally works in D&D, right? So traditionally, Dungeons & Dragons is a heroic fantasy game. When you add in this element of like grotesque, pulpy sci-fi horror, that can work. It fits, you know, because the fantasy genre has so many connectors in all different directions that you can get historically inspired plots, and you could have a noir murder mystery, and you could have, you know, a political plot, and you could have a ghost story, and you could have this. But you usually don't do those variations from the core genre more than a couple of times. And if you had to pick one pulpy alien sci-fi horror monster for the player characters to fight, it'd be a Mind Flayer. It's not that there's anything wrong with the Brain Collector, it's just that they're in, not competition necessarily, but that they tend to get overshadowed by the more famous monster that fills a similar aesthetic niche, even though, I think in mechanical terms, they're quite different. But generally speaking, when we're looking at villain-class monsters, those classics are going to outcompete newly introduced slight variants on the classics, simply because the classics fit the aesthetic that we're trying to achieve. It's not that the new ones
fit them badly, but that the classics fit them that much better, and we're probably not going to do those things more than a small number of times. So that is about all the monsters that we have time for this episode. In our next episode, we're going to be continuing our journey through the creature catalog as we talk about the Cheval and the Death Demon right here on Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great. Thank you for listening.
If you have a favorite monster or something you'd like me to talk about, you can reach me on Twitter at GonzoHistory or by email, gonzohistory@gmail.com. To support Monster Man, just go to patreon.com/monsterman. Thank you to Ray Otis for designing the thumbnail image. Our introductory music is Solve the Damn Mystery by Jesse Spillane from the album Descent of the Goober Monster, used under a Creative Commons Attribution License. Thank you again for listening, and please join us next time.